When Candy Kendall and Wally Worthington fell in love with each other in the summer of 1940-something, everyone in Hearts Haven and in Hearts Rock always knew they would. It was a wonder only that it had taken them this long to discover it themselves. For years, both towns had thought them perfect for each other. Even crusty Raymond Kendall approved. Ray thought Wally was unfocused, but that was not the same as lazy, and anyone could see the boy was good-hearted. Ray also approved of Wally's mother. He had a thorough liking for the way Olive Worthington respected work. Everyone felt sorry for how out of it poor Senior seemed, how his drinking, they thought, had aged him overnight. "It won't be long, Alice, before the guy's pissing his pants in public," the charmless Bucky Bean said to Olive. And Candy thought that Olive Worthington would be a perfect mother-in-law. When Candy dreamed of her own mother, grown older than she'd been allowed to grow in this life, grown naturally older in a better world, she always thought her mother would have aged to resemble Olive Worthington. Candy hoped at least that her mother would have managed Olive's refinement, if not perhaps her college-learned New British. Candy would be going to college in a year, she assumed, and she had no intentions of learning an accent there. But except for the accent, Candy thought Olive Worthington was wonderful. It was sad about Senior, but the man was certainly sweet. So everyone was happy with this love affair that was as certain to become a marriage made in heaven as any love affair Hearts Haven and Hearts Rock had seen. It was understood that Wally would finish college first, and that Candy would be allowed to finish college, if she wanted to, before they got married. But with Olive Worthington's instincts for worry, one might have assumed that Olive would have foreseen the possible causes for a change of plans. After all, it was 1940-something. There was a war in Europe. There were many people who thought that more than Europe would be involved before long. But Olive had a mother's wish to keep war out of her mind. Wilbur Larch had the war in Europe very much on his mind. He had been in the last war, and he foresaw that if there was another war, it might coincide with Homer Wells as being the right age to go. Since that would be the wrong age to be, the good doctor had already taken some pains to see that Homer Wells wouldn't have to go to a war, if there was one. Larch was, after all, the historian of St. Cloud's. He wrote the only records that were kept there. He usually wrote the not-so-simple history of the place, but he had tried his hand at fiction, too. In the case of Fuzzy Stone, for example, and in the other very few cases of orphans who had died in his care, Wilbur Larch hadn't liked the actual endings, hadn't wanted to record the actual outcomes to those small, foreshortened lives. Wasn't it fair if Larch took liberties, if he occasionally indulged himself with happy endings? In the case of the few who had died, Wilbur Larch made up a longer life for them. For example, the history of F. Stone read like a case study of what Wilbur Larch wished for Homer Wells. Following Fuzzy's most successful adoption, every member of the adoptive family was scrupulously described, and the most successful treatment and cure imaginable of Fuzzy's respiratory difficulties, the young man would pursue an education at none other than Bowdoin College, Wilbur Larch's own alma mater, and study medicine at Harvard Medical School. He would even follow Larch's footsteps to internships at Mass General and at the Boston Lying In. Larch intended to make a devoted and skilled obstetrician out of Fuzzy Stone. The orphan's fictional history was as carefully done as everything Wilbur Larch did, allowing a possible exception for his use of ether, and Larch was especially pleased to note that some of his fictional history was more convincing than what had actually happened to some of the others. Snowy Meadows, for example, would be adopted by a family in Bangor by the name of Marsh. Who would believe that a Meadows became a Marsh? Wilbur Larch was pleased with himself for making up better stories than that. The Marshes were in the furniture business, and Snowy, who had been unimaginatively named Robert, would attend the University of Maine only briefly before marrying some local flower and going into the Marsh family furniture business as a salesman. "It's for keeps," Snowy would write Dr. Larch about the girl who caused him to drop out of school. "And I really love the furniture business." Whenever he wrote to Dr. Larch, Snowy Meadows, alias Robert Marsh, would always ask, "Say, what's happened to Homer Wells?" The next thing you know, Larch thought, Snowy Meadows will suggest a reunion. Larch grumbled to himself for days, trying to think of what to say to Snowy Meadows about Homer. He would have liked to brag about Homer's perfect procedure with the eclampsia patient. But Larch was aware that his training of Homer Wells, and the business of the Lord's work and the devil's work in St. Cloud's, would not meet with everyone's approval. "Homer is still with us," Larch would write to Snowy, ambiguously. "Snowy is a sneaky one," Larch concluded. Snowy Meadows also never failed to ask, in each of his letters, about Fuzzy Stone. "What's happening with Fuzzy these days?" Snowy always asked, and Wilbur Larch would carefully check the history he had written for Fuzzy, just to keep Snowy up to date. Larch ignored Snowy's requests for Fuzzy Stone's address. Dr. Larch was convinced that the young furniture salesman, Robert Marsh, was a dogged sort of fool who, if he had any of the other orphans' addresses, would bother everyone about starting an orphan club or an orphan society. Larch even complained to Nurse Edna and to Nurse Angela about Snowy Meadows, saying, "I wish someone out of Maine had adopted that one, someone far away. That Snowy Meadows is so stupid. He writes to me as if I ran a boarding school. The next thing you know, he'll expect me to publish an alumni magazine." This was a somewhat unfeeling remark to make to Nurse Edna and to Nurse Angela, Larch realized later. These two dear but sentimental ladies would have jumped at the idea of an alumni magazine. They missed every orphan they ever gave away. If things were up to them, there would be reunions planned every year, every month, Larch thought, and groaned. He lay down in the dispensary. He thought about a slight modification he had been shrewd enough to make in the history of Homer Wells. He would tell Homer about it one day, if the situation demanded it. He was very pleased with himself for this slight fiction that he had so skillfully blended with the actual history of Homer Wells. Of course, he'd included nothing of the medical training. He had incriminated himself by what he'd written about the abortions many times, but Larch knew well enough that Homer Wells should be left out of that written history. What Wilbur Larch had written about Homer Wells was that the boy had a heart defect, a heart that was damaged and weakened from birth. Larch had even taken the trouble to make this the first entry about Homer, which necessitated his locating some older-looking paper and painstakingly revising and retyping all the earlier and actual history. But he managed to work in the heart defect in the correctly casual places. The reference was always vague and uncharacteristically lacking in medical precision. The words defect and damaged and weakened would not have convinced a good detective or even a good doctor, whom Wilbur Larch imagined he might one day need to convince. In fact, he worried a little if he could convince Homer of it, given what the boy had learned. But Larch would face that if and when the situation arose. The situation Larch was thinking of was war, the so-called war in Europe. Larch and many others feared that the war wouldn't stay there. "I'm sorry, Homer," Larch imagined having to tell the boy. "I don't want you to worry, but you have a bad heart. It just wouldn't stand up to a war." What Larch meant was that his own heart would never stand up to Homer Wells's going to war. The love of Wilbur Larch for Homer Wells extended even to his tampering with history, a field wherein he was an admitted amateur, but it was nonetheless a field that he respected and also loved. In an earlier entry in the file on Homer Wells, an entry that Dr. Larch removed, for it lent an incorrect tone of voice, or at least a tone of voice unusual for history, Dr. Larch had written, "I love nothing or no one as much as I love Homer Wells. Period." Thus, Wilbur Larch was more prepared for how a war could change important plans than Olive Worthington was prepared for it. The other and more probable cause for a change in the wedding plans of her son and Candy Kendall, another way in which the young lover's plans could be changed, had been foreseen by Olive. It was an unwanted pregnancy. A pity that it was not foreseen by either Candy or Wally. Thus, when Candy got pregnant, she'd been a virgin, naturally, she and Wally were much distressed, but they were also surprised. Olive would have been distressed, had she known, but she wouldn't have been surprised. Getting pregnant would never have surprised Wilbur Larch, who knew that it happened, and happened by accident all the time. But Candy Kendall and Wally Worthington, so full of beauty and of the moment and of their own rightness for each other, simply couldn't believe it. They were not the sort of people who would have been ashamed or unable to tell their parents. They were simply stunned at the prospect of having to derail their perfect plans, of having to get married ahead of schedule. Did Wally Worthington need a college degree to inherit his parents' apple orchard? Of course not. Did Candy Kendall need to go to college at all? She didn't. Wouldn't she refine herself and educate herself if left to her own means? Of course she would. And Wally wasn't much of a student anyway, was he? Of course he wasn't. He was a botany major, but only at the insistence of his mother. Olive thought that the study of plants might stimulate her son to become more excited and more knowledgeable about apple growing. "It's just that we're not ready," Candy said to Wally. "I mean, we aren't, are we? Do you feel ready?" "I love you," Wally said. He was a brave boy, and true, and Candy, who had not cried a single tear at the surprising discovery that she was with child, loved him too. "But it's just not the right time for us, is it, Wally?" Candy asked him. "I want to marry you any time," he said truthfully. But he added something that she hadn't thought of. He had thought of the war in Europe, even if his mother had missed it. He said, "What if there's a war? I mean, what if we get involved in it?" "What if what?" said Candy, truly shocked. "I mean, if we were at war, I'd go. I'd have to. I'd want to," Wally said. "Only if there was a child, it wouldn't feel right, going to a war." "When would it feel right to go to a war, Wally?" Candy asked him. "Well, I mean, I'd just have to, that's all, if we had one," he said. "I mean, it's our country, and besides, for the experience, I couldn't miss it." She slapped his face. She started to cry in a rage. "For the experience? You'd want to go to war for the experience?" "Well, not if we had a child. That's when it wouldn't feel right," Wally said. "Would it?" He was about as innocent as rain, and about as thoughtless. "What about me?" Candy asked, still shocked, and shocked further that she had slapped him. She put her hand very softly where his cheek was so red. "With or without a child, what would it be like for me if you went to a war?" "Well, it's all what if, isn't it?" Wally asked. "It's just something to think about," he added. "About the business of the child, especially, I think. If you see what I mean," he said. "I think we should try not to have the baby," Candy told him. "I won't have you going to one of those places where there's no real doctor," Wally said. "Of course not," she agreed. "But aren't there any real doctors who do it?" "It's not what I've heard," Wally admitted. He was too much of a gentleman to tell her what he'd heard, that there was a butcher in Cape Kenneth who did you for $500. You went to a parking lot and put a blindfold around yourself and waited. You went alone. Someone picked you up and took you to the butcher. You were brought back when the butcher was through. You were blindfolded throughout. And what was worse, you had to appear absolutely hysterical in front of some fairly dignified and local doctor before the doctor would even tell you where the parking lot was and how you got in contact with the butcher. If you didn't act upset enough, if you weren't completely crazy, the doctor wouldn't put you in touch with the butcher. That was the story Wally had heard, and he wanted no part of any of it for Candy. He doubted if Candy would act upset enough anyway. Wally would have the baby instead of any of that. He'd marry Candy and be happy about it, too. It was what he wanted one day anyway. The story Wally had heard was partially true. You did have to go to the fairly dignified and local doctor, and you did have to work yourself up into a frenzy, and if the doctor thought you were ready to drown yourself, only then would he tell you the location of the parking lot and how to approach the butcher. What Wally didn't know was the more human part of the story. If you were calm and collected and well-spoken and obviously sane, the doctor would skip the whole story about the parking lot and the butcher. If you looked like a reasonable woman, someone who wouldn't turn him in later, the doctor would simply give you an abortion, right there in his office, for $500. And if you acted like a nut, he also gave you an abortion, right there in his office, for $500. The only difference was that you had to stand around blindfolded in a parking lot and think that you were being operated on by a butcher. That's what acting crazy got you. What was decidedly unjust in either case was that the doctor charged $500. But Wally Worthington was not seeking the correct information about that doctor, or that so-called butcher. He hoped to get advice about another abortionist somewhere, and he had a vague plan concerning the people he'd ask. There was little point in seeking the advice of the members of the Haven Club. He'd been told that one member had actually taken a cruise to Sweden for an abortion, but that was out of the question for Candy. Wally knew the orchard men at Ocean View were the sort of men who might have need of a less extravagant remedy. He also knew that they liked him and that, with few exceptions, they could be trusted to keep what Wally thought was a reliable, manly confidence about the matter. He went first to the only bachelor on the orchard crew, supposing that bachelors, and this one was also a notorious ladies' man, might have more use for abortionists than a married man. Wally approached a member of the Apple crew named Herb Fowler, a man only a few years older than Wally. He was good-looking in a too-thin, too-cruel kind of way, with a too-thin mustache on his dark lip. Herb Fowler's present girlfriend worked in the packing house during harvest. During the times of the year when the Apple Mart was open, she worked with the other Mart women. She was younger than Herb, just a local girl, about Candy's age. Her name was Louise Toby, and the men called her Squeeze Louise, which was apparently okay with Herb. He was rumored to have other girlfriends, and he had the appalling habit of carrying lots of prophylactics on him, at all times of the day and night. And when anyone said anything at all about sex, Herb Fowler would reach into his pocket for a rubber and flip it at the speaker, all rolled up in its wrapper, of course. He'd just flip a prophylactic and say, "See these? They keep a fella free." Wally had already had several rubbers flipped at him, and he was tired of the joke, and he was not in the best humor to have the joke played on him again in his present situation. But he imagined that Herb Fowler was the right sort of man to ask, that despite the rubbers, Herb Fowler was always getting girls in trouble. One way or another, Herb looked like trouble for every girl alive. "Hey, Herb," Wally said to him. It was a rainy, late spring day. College was out, and Wally was working alongside Herb in the storage cellar, which was empty in the spring. They were varnishing ladders, and when they finished the ladders, they would start painting the tracks for the conveyors that ran nonstop when the packing house was in full operation. Every year, everything was repainted. "Yep, that's my name," Herb said. He kept a cigarette so fixedly drooped from his lips that his eyes were always squinted half-shut, and he kept his long face tipped up and back so that he could inhale the trail of smoke through his nose. "Herb, I was wondering," Wally said, "if you got a girl pregnant, what would you do about it? Knowing your view," Wally smartly added, "about keeping yourself free." That stole Herb's punchline and probably made Herb cross. He had a rubber half out of his pocket, ready to flip at Wally while delivering his usual remark on the subject. But Wally saying it for him forced him to arrest the motion of his flipping hand. He never brought the rubber out. "Who'd you knock up?" Herb asked instead. Wally corrected him. "I didn't say I'd knock up anybody. I asked you what you'd do, if..." Herb Fowler disappointed Wally. All he knew about was the same mysterious parking lot in Cape Kenneth, something about a blindfold, a butcher, and $500. "Maybe Meanie Hyde would know about it," Herb added. "Why don't you ask Meanie what he'd do if he knocked anybody up?" Herb Fowler smiled at Wally. He was not a nice character, but Wally wouldn't satisfy him. Wally just smiled back. Meanie Hyde was a nice man. He'd grown up with a bunch of older brothers who beat him up and otherwise abused him steadily. His brothers had nicknamed him Meanie, probably just to confuse him. Meanie was ever friendly. He had a friendly wife, Florence, who was one of the packing house and Apple Mart women. There had been so many children that Wally couldn't remember all their names or tell one from the other, and therefore he found it hard to imagine that Meanie Hyde even knew what an abortion was. "Meanie listens to everything," Herb Fowler told Wally. "Don't you ever watch Meanie? What's he do except listen?" So Wally went to find Meanie Hyde. Meanie was waxing the press boards for the cider press. He was generally in charge of the cider mill, and because of his nice disposition, he was often in charge of overseeing all the cider house activities, including the dealings with the migrant workers who lived in the cider house during the harvest. Olive made a point of keeping Herb Fowler at a considerable distance from those poor migrant workers. Herb's disposition was not so agreeable. Wally watched Meany Hyde waxing for a while. The sharp but clean odor of the fermented cider and the old cider apples was strongest on a wet day, but Meany seemed to like it. Wally didn't mind it either. "Say Meany," Wally said after a while. "I thought you forgot my name," Meany said cheerfully. "Meany, what do you know about abortion?" Wally asked. "I know it's a sin," Meany Hyde said. "And I know Grace Lynch has had one. In her case, I sympathize with her, if you know what I mean." Grace Lynch was Vernon Lynch's wife. Wally, and everyone else, knew that Vernon beat her. They had no children. It was rumored that this was the result of Vernon's beating Grace so much that Grace's organs of generation, as Homer Wells knew them, were damaged. Grace was one of the pie women during the harvest, and when the apple mart was humming. Wally wondered if she'd be working today. There was lots to do in the orchards on a good day in late spring, but when it was raining, there was just painting and washing, or fixing up the cider house to get it ready for the harvest. It was just like Meany Hyde to be waxing the press boards too early. Someone would probably tell him to wax them again just before it was time for the first press. But Meany didn't like painting or washing up, and when it rained, he could kill whole days fussing over his beloved cider press. "Who do you know needs an abortion, Wally?" Meany Hyde asked. "A friend of a friend," Wally said, which would have prompted a rubber from Herb Fowler's pocket, but Meany was nice. He took no pleasure in anyone else's bad luck. "Well, that's a shame, Wally," Meany said. "I think you should speak to Grace about it. Just don't speak to her when Vernon's around." Wally didn't have to be told that. He had often seen the bruises on the backs of Grace Lynch's arms where Vernon had grabbed her and shook her. Once he had seized her by the arms and yanked her toward him, lowering his head in order to butt her in the face. This had happened, Wally knew, because Senior had paid for Grace's dental work. She told Senior and Olive that she'd fallen downstairs. Vernon had also beaten up a black man, one of the migrants, in the orchard called Old Trees, several harvests ago. The men had been telling jokes, and the black man had offered a joke of his own. Vernon hadn't liked a black man telling jokes that had anything to do with sex. He'd told Wally, in fact, that black people should be prevented from having sex. "But pretty soon," Vernon had said, "there'll be too many of them." In the Old Trees orchard, Vernon had snapped the man off his ladder, and when the man picked himself up off the ground, Vernon held both his arms and butted him in the face over and over again, until Everett Taft, who was one of the foremen, and Ira Titcomb, the beekeeper, had to pull Vernon off. The black man had taken over 20 stitches in his mouth, in his lips, and in his tongue. Everyone knew Grace Lynch hadn't lost her teeth falling down any stairs. It was Vernon who should have had Meany's name, or something worse. "Wally," Meany asked him as he was leaving the cider house, "don't tell Grace I told you to ask her." So Wally went looking for Grace Lynch. He drove the pickup through the muddy lane that divided the orchard called Frying Pan, because it was in a valley and was the hottest to work in, from the orchard called Doris, after someone's wife. He drove to the building called Number 2. It was simply the second building for keeping the larger vehicles. The sprayers were sheltered in Number 2 because the building was more isolated, and the sprayers and the chemicals that went inside them stank. Vernon Lynch was painting in there. He had a spray gun with a long needle-like nozzle, and he was hosing down the hardy 500-gallon sprayer with a fresh coat of apple red. Vernon wore a respirator to protect himself from the paint fumes. It was the same mask the men wore when they sprayed the trees. And he wore his foul-weather gear, the complete oilskin suit. Wally somehow knew it was Vernon, although not a single feature of Vernon was visible. Vernon had a way of attacking his work that made his actions unmistakably his. And Wally noticed that Vernon was painting the hardy as if he were wielding a flamethrower. Wally drove on. He didn't want to ask Vernon where his wife was today. Wally shuddered as he imagined several of Vernon's leering responses. In the empty off-season apple mart, three of the mart women were smoking cigarettes and talking. They didn't have much to do. and when they saw the boss's son coming, they didn't throw down their coffee cups, stamp out their cigarettes, and disperse in different directions. They just stepped a little away from one another and smiled at Wally sheepishly. Florence Hyde, Meany's wife, didn't even pretend to be busy at anything. She dragged at her cigarette and called out to Wally, "Hi, honey."
"Hi, Florence," Wally said, smiling.
Big Dot Taft, who'd miraculously run a mile, getting stung all the while, the night Senior had dumped Ira Titcomb's bees, put out her cigarette and picked up an empty crate. Then she put the crate down and wondered where she'd left her broom.
"Hi, cutie," Dot said to Wally cheerfully.
"What's new?" Wally asked the women.
"Nothing new here," said Irene Titcomb, Ira's wife. She laughed and turned her face away. She was always laughing, and turning away the side of her face with the burn scar, as if she were meeting you for the first time and could keep the scar a secret. The accident had happened years ago, and there couldn't have been anyone in Hartshaven or Harts Rock who hadn't seen Irene Titcomb's scar and didn't know the exact details of how she got it. One night Ira Titcomb had sat out in his yard all night with an oil torch and a shotgun. Something had been getting into his hives, probably a bear or a raccoon. Irene had known this was Ira's plan, yet she was surprised when she woke up, hearing him calling her. He was on the lawn and waving the lit torch under her window. All she saw was the torchlight. He asked her to make him some bacon and eggs, if she wouldn't mind, because he was so bored waiting for whatever it was he intended to shoot that he'd gotten hungry. Irene was humming to herself, watching the bacon fry, when Ira came to the kitchen window and tapped on the pane to find out if the food was ready. Irene was unprepared for the vision of Ira in his beekeeper suit, moving out of the darkness and into the faint light from the kitchen window with fire in his hands. She had seen her husband in his beekeeper suit many times, but she hadn't imagined that he'd be wearing it while he waited to shoot a bear or a coon. She'd never seen the way the suit glowed in firelight or at night, either. Ira had worn the suit because he'd imagined that his shotgun blast might rip into one of the hives and loose a few bees. He had no intention of scaring his wife, but poor Irene looked out the window and saw what she thought was a flaming white apparition. No doubt this was what had been molesting the hives. The ghost of a beekeeper of bygone days. It had probably killed poor Ira and was now coming for her. The frying pan flew up in her hands, splashing the hot bacon grease on her face. Irene was lucky she didn't blind herself. Oh, those at-home accidents, how they surprise you. "What you want, big boy?"
Big Dot Taft asked Wally. The Applemart women teased and flirted with Wally endlessly. They thought he was gorgeous and a lot of fun, and these three had known him since he was a little boy.
"He wants to take us for a ride," cried Irene Titcomb, still laughing, her face still turned away.
"Why don't you take us to a movie, Wally?" Florence Hyde asked him.
"Oh, God, what I wouldn't do for you, Wally," Dot Taft said, "if you took me to a movie."
"Don't you want to make us happy, Wally?" Florence asked him, whining a little.
"Maybe Wally's going to fire us," Irene Titcomb shrieked, and that broke up the three of them.
Dot Taft roared so loud that Florence Hyde inhaled her cigarette the wrong way and began to cough, which made Dot roar some more.
"Is Grace here today?" Wally asked casually, when the women calmed down.
"Oh, God, he wants Grace," Dot Taft said.
"What's she got that we haven't got?"
"Bruises," Wally thought. "Broken bones, false teeth. Certainly genuine aches and pains."
"I just want to ask her something," Wally said, smiling shyly. His shyness was deliberate. He handled himself very smoothly around the Mart women.
"I'll bet she'll say no," Irene Titcomb said, giggling.
"No, everyone says yes to Wally," Florence Hyde teased.
Wally allowed the laughter to subside. Then Dot Taft said, "Grace is cleaning the pie oven."
"Thank you, ladies," Wally said, bowing, blowing them kisses, backing away.
"You're bad, Wally," Florence Hyde told him. "You just came here to make us jealous."
"That Grace must have a hot oven," Dot Taft said,
and this started more laughter and coughing.
"Don't get burned, Wally," Irene Titcomb called after him, and he left the Mart women chattering and smoking at a higher pitch than when he'd found them.
He was not surprised that Grace Lynch had drawn the worst job for a rainy day. The other women sympathized with her, but she was not one of them. She stood apart, as if she were afraid everyone might suddenly turn on her and beat her as badly as Vernon did, as if the beatings she'd already survived had cost her the necessary humor for trading stories equally with Florence and Irene and Dot. Grace Lynch was much thinner and a little younger than these women. Her thinness was unusual among the regular Mart women. Even Herb Fowler's girlfriend, Squeeze Louise, was heftier than Grace, and Dot Taft's kid sister, Deborah Pettigrew, who was fairly regular in pie season and when the assembly line to the packing house was running. Even Deborah had more flesh on her than Grace had. And since she had needed new teeth, Grace was even tighter-lipped than usual. It was a grim concentration to the narrow line of her mouth. Wally couldn't remember ever seeing Grace Lynch laugh, and some form of yucking it up was essential to relieve the boredom of the life of the Applemart women. Grace was simply the cowed dog among them. She didn't look as if she took any pleasure from eating pie, or from eating anything at all. She didn't smoke, and in 1940-something everyone smoked, even Wally. She was noise-shy and flinched around the machinery. Wally hoped she was wearing long sleeves so that he wouldn't have to look at the bruises on her arms. But she was half in one of the deep shelves of the pie oven when Wally found her. She was wearing a long-sleeved shirt, but both sleeves were rolled up above her elbows to spare the shirt some of the oven black. Wally startled her with her head in the oven, and half her body, too, and Grace made a little cry and banged one of her elbows against the door hinge as she withdrew in too much of a hurry. "Sorry I scared you, Grace," Wally said quickly. It was hard to walk up on Grace without making her bump into something. She said nothing. She rubbed one elbow. She folded and unfolded her thin arms, hiding her very slight breasts, or, by keeping her arms in constant motion, concealing her bruises. She wouldn't look Wally in the eye. As poised as Wally was, he always felt a terrific tension when he tried to talk with her. He felt she might suddenly run away from him, or throw herself at him, either with her claws out or kissing him with her tongue stabbing. He wondered if she mistook his inescapable search for the new bruises on her body for a sexual interest. Maybe that was part of the problem between them. "That poor woman is just crazy," Ray Kendall had told Wally once. Maybe that was all. "Grace?" Wally asked, and Grace trembled. She was squeezing a wad of steel wool so tightly that the dirty suds streaked down one arm and wet the waist of her shirt and the bony hip of her denim work jeans. A single tooth, probably false, appeared out of her mouth and clenched a tiny piece of her lower lip. "Grace," Wally said, "I've got a problem." She stared at him as if this news frightened her more than anything anyone had ever told her. She looked quickly away and said, "I'm cleaning the oven." Wally thought he might have to grab her to keep her from crawling back in the oven. He suddenly realized that all his secrets, that anyone's secrets, were entirely safe with Grace Lynch. There was absolutely nothing she dared to say, and no one in her life to tell it to, if she ever got up the courage. "Candy is pregnant," Wally said to Grace, who wobbled as if a wind had come up, or the strong ammonia fumes of the oven cleaner had overpowered her. She looked at Wally again with her eyes as round as a rabbit's. "I need advice," Wally said to her. It occurred to him that if Vernon Lynch saw him talking to Grace, Vernon would probably find that just cause for giving Grace another beating. "Please just tell me what you know, Grace," Wally said. Grace Lynch spat it out from between her very tight lips. "St. Clouds," she hissed. It was a loud whisper. Wally thought it was someone's name, the name of a saint, or else a kind of nickname for an exceptionally evil abortionist. St. Clouds. Grace Lynch, it was clear, had no luck. If she'd been to an abortionist, wouldn't it have to be the worst abortionist one could imagine? "I don't know the doctor's name," Grace confided, still whispering and not looking up at Wally anymore. She would never again look up at him. "The place is called St. Clouds, and the doctor's good. He's kind of gentle. He makes it okay." For her, this was virtually a sermon, at least a speech. "But don't make her go alone, okay, Wally?" Grace said, actually reaching out and touching him, but recoiling the instant she made contact, as if Wally's skin were hotter than the pie oven when it was fired up. "No, I won't make her go alone, of course," Wally promised her. "You ask for the orphanage when you get off the train," Grace said. She climbed back in the oven before he could thank her. Grace Lynch had gone to St. Cloud's alone. Vernon hadn't even known she was going, or he would probably have beaten her for it. Since she'd been gone overnight, he'd beaten her for that, but perhaps it was a lesser beating by his standards. Grace had arrived in the early evening just after dark. As was customary, she'd not been housed with the expectant mothers. She'd been so jittery that Dr. Larch's sedation had not affected her very much, and she'd been awake through the night, listening to everything. It had been before Homer's days as an apprentice, so if Homer had seen her, he would never remember her, and when, one day, Grace Lynch would see Homer Wells, she wouldn't recognize him. She'd had the standard D&C at a proper and safe time in her pregnancy, and there'd been no complications, except in her dreams. There'd never been any serious complications following any abortion Dr. Larch had ever performed, and no permanent damage from any of the operations, unless it was something so interior, so very much in the mind, that Dr. Larch couldn't have been responsible for it. Still, though Nurse Edna and Nurse Angela had made her feel welcome, and Larch had been, as Grace had told Wally, gentle, Grace Lynch hated to think of St. Cloud's. It was not so much for her own experience, or because of her own trouble, but because of the atmosphere of the place in the long night she'd stayed awake. The dense air hung like a great weight, the disturbed river smelled like death, the cries of the babies were weirder than the cries of loons, and there were owls, and someone peeing, and someone walking around. There was a far-off machine, the typewriter, and a shout from another building, just one long wail. Possibly that had been Melanie. After Wally had visited with her, Grace balked at finishing the pie oven job. She felt sick to her stomach. It was like the cramps she'd had that time. And she went out to the Apple Mart and asked the women there if they'd finished the oven for her. She just didn't feel well, she said. Nobody teased Grace. Big Dot Taft asked her if she'd like a ride home, and Irene Titcomb and Florence Hyde, who had nothing to do anyway, said they'd tackle the oven in two shakes, as they say in Maine. Grace Lynch went to find Olive Worthington. She told Olive she wasn't feeling well and was going home early. Olive was her usual kind self regarding the matter. When she saw Vernon Lynch later, she gave Vernon a glare, hard enough for Vernon to feel discomforted by it. He was cleaning the nozzle for the spray gun down at number two when Olive cruised past him in the faded pickup. Olive's look was such that Vernon wondered for a moment if he'd been fired, if that look was all the notice he was going to get. But the thought quickly passed, the way thoughts tended to pass through Vernon Lynch. He looked at the muddy tracks left by Olive's pickup and said something typical. "Suck my dick, you rich bitch," Vernon Lynch said. Then he continued to clean out the spray gun nozzle. That night, Wally sat on Ray Kendall's dock with Candy and told her what little he knew about St. Cloud's. He didn't know, for example, that there was an apostrophe. He'd not bothered to apply to Harvard. His grades weren't good enough to get him into Bowdoin. The University of Maine, where he was half-heartedly majoring in botany, hadn't taught him a thing about grammar. "I knew it was an orphanage," Candy said. "That's all I knew." It was clear to them both that no good excuse could be invented for their being gone overnight, so Wally arranged to borrow Senior's Cadillac. They would have to leave very early in the morning and return in the evening of the same day. Wally told Senior it was the best time of year to explore the coast, and maybe drive a little inland. The coast would have more tourists as the summer progressed, and inland it would get too hot for a comfortable drive. "I know it's a work day," Wally told Olive. "What's one day matter, Mom? It's just to have a little adventure with Candy, just a day off." Olive wondered if Wally would ever amount to anything. Ray Kendall had his own work to worry about. He knew Candy would be happy to take a drive with Wally. Wally was a good driver, if a trifle fast, and the Cadillac, Ray knew better than anyone, was a safe car. Ray did all the work on it. The night before their trip, Candy and Wally went to bed early, but each of them was awake through the night. Like most truly loving young couples, they found themselves worrying about what effect this experience would have on the other. Wally worried that an abortion would make Candy unhappy or even uncomfortable with sex. Candy wondered if Wally would feel the same way about her after all this was over. That same night, Wilbur Larch and Homer Wells weren't sleeping either. Larch sat at the typewriter in Nurse Angela's office. Through the window, he saw Homer Wells walking around outside with an oil lamp in the darkness. "What is the matter now?" Larch wondered, and he went to see what Homer was doing. "I couldn't sleep," Homer told Larch. "What is it this time?" Dr. Larch asked Homer. "Maybe it's just an owl," said Homer Wells. The oil lamp didn't project very far into the darkness, and the wind was strong, which was unusual for St. Cloud's. When the wind blew out the lamp, the doctor and his assistant saw that they were backlit by the light shining from the window of Nurse Angela's office. It was the only light for miles around, and it made their shadows gigantic. Larch's shadow reached across the stripped, unplanted plot of ground, up the barren hillside, all the way into the black woods. Homer Wells's shadow touched the dark sky. It was only then that both men noticed. Homer had grown taller than Dr. Larch. "I'll be damned," Larch muttered, spreading his arms so that his shadow looked like a magician about to reveal something. Larch flapped his arms like a big bat. "Look," he said to Homer, "I'm a sorcerer." Homer Wells, the sorcerer's apprentice, flapped his arms too. The wind was very strong and fresh. The usual density in the air above St. Cloud's had lifted. The stars shone bright and cold. The memory of cigar smoke and sawdust was missing from this new air. "Feel that wind," said Homer Wells. Maybe the wind was keeping him up. "It's a wind coming from the coast," Wilbur Larch said. He sniffed deeply for traces of salt. It was a rare sea breeze, Larch was sure. "Wherever it's from, it's nice," Homer Wells decided. Both men stood sniffing the wind. Each man thought, "What is going to happen to me?" Chapter 5. Homer Breaks a Promise. The stationmaster at St. Cloud's was a lonely, unattractive man, a victim of mail-order catalogs, and of an especially crackpot mail-order religion. The latter, whose publication took an almost comic book form, was delivered monthly. The last month's issue, for example, had a cover illustration of a skeleton in soldier's clothes flying on a winged zebra over a battlefield that vaguely resembled the trenches of World War I. The other mail-order catalogs were of a more standard variety, but the stationmaster was such a victim of his superstitions that his dreams frequently confused the images of his mail-order religious material with the household gadgets, nursing bras, folding chairs, and giant zucchinis he saw advertised in the catalogs. Thus it was not unusual for him to be awakened in a night terror by a vision of coffins levitating from a picture-perfect garden, the prize-winning vegetables taking flight with the corpses. There was one catalog devoted entirely to fishing equipment. The stationmaster's cadavers were often seen in waders or carrying rods and nets. And then there were the undergarment catalogs advertising bras and girdles. The flying dead in bras and girdles especially frightened the stationmaster. The most particularly crackpot aspect of the mail-order religion was its insistence on the presence of the growing numbers of the restless, homeless, unsaved dead. In areas of the world more populated than St. Cloud's, the stationmaster imagined that these luckless souls were crowding the sky. The arrival of Dr. Larch's Clara fitted ominously into the stationmaster's pattern of night terrors and contributed to his especially stricken appearance upon the arrival of every new train. Although Larch had assured the moron that there would be no new bodies arriving for at least a year or two. To the stationmaster, the notion of Judgment Day was as tangible as the weather. He hated the first train of the morning the most. It was the milk train, and in any weather, the heavy cans were covered with a cold sweat. The empty cans which were put on the train produced a kind of death knell, a hollow bonging noise, as they tapped the wooden station platform or were handed up the iron stairs. The first train of the morning was the mail train, too. Although the station master was eager for new catalogs, he never lost his fear of the mail, of what might be coming his way. If not another cadaver, sloshing in embalming fluid, then the monthly warning from the mail-order religion that Judgment Day was at hand, always sooner than it was last expected, and always with more terrifying verve. The stationmaster lived to be shocked. A hole in a tomato could cause him to escalate his pre-dawn bouts of feverish prayer. Dead animals, of whatever cause, made him tremble. He believed the creature's souls clogged the air he needed to breathe or were capable of invading his body. They were certainly capable of contributing to his sleeplessness, for the stationmaster was as veteran an insomniac as Wilbur Larch and Homer Wells, and was without the benefit of ether, youth, or education. This time it was the wind that awakened him, he was sure. Something like a bat was blown off course and struck his house. He was convinced that a flying animal had died violently against his wall, and that its rabid soul was circling around outside, seeking entry. Then the wind made a moaning sound as it funneled through the spokes of the stationmaster's bicycle. A sudden gust knocked the bicycle off its kickstand. It clattered on the brick path, its little thumb bell dinging feebly, as if one of the world's restless souls had failed in an attempt to steal it. The stationmaster sat up in bed and screamed. He had been advised in the monthly mail-order religious publication that screaming was of some, if not certain, protection against homeless souls. Indeed, the stationmaster's scream was not without effect. Its shrillness dislodged a pigeon from the eaves of the house, and, since no pigeon desires to fly at night, the bird hopped and scrabbled its way noisily across the stationmaster's roof, looking for a quieter corner. The stationmaster lay on his back, staring straight up at his roof. He expected the wandering soul to descend at any moment upon him. The pigeon's coo was the cry of another tortured sinner, the stationmaster was sure. He got up and stared out of his bedroom window, his nightlight weakly illuminating the small plot he had recently tilled for his vegetable garden. The freshly turned earth shocked him. He mistook it for a ready grave. It gave him such a turn that he quickly dressed himself and tramped outside. Another thing he had learned from his mail-order religion was that the souls of the dead cannot invade an active body. You mustn't be caught sleeping or even standing still, that was the main thing. And so the stationmaster boldly set out for a brisk walk through St. Cloud's. He muttered threateningly at the would-be ghosts he saw everywhere. "Go away," he growled, at this building, at that sound, at every unclear shadow. A dog barked in one house. The stationmaster surprised a raccoon, busy with someone's garbage, but live animals didn't bother him. He hissed at the coon and appeared satisfied when the coon hissed back. He chose to stay away from the abandoned buildings where, he remembered, that fat nightmare of a girl from the orphanage had caused so much damage. He knew that in those buildings, the lost souls were both numerous and fierce. He felt safer around the orphanage. Though he was frightened of Dr. Larch, the stationmaster became fairly aggressive in the presence of children and their imagined souls. Like most easily frightened people, the stationmaster was something of a bully when he perceived that he had the upper hand. "Damn kids," he muttered, passing the girls' division. He had trouble thinking of the girls' division without imagining doing terrible things with that great big ruffian girl. The Destroyer, he called her. He'd had more than one night terror regarding her. She was often the model of the many bras and girdles in his dreams. He paused only briefly by the girls' division, sniffing deeply. He thought he might catch some scent of Melanie, the building wrecker. But the wind was too strong. The wind was everywhere. "It's a Judgment Day wind," he thought, and walked quickly on. He was not going to stand still long enough for some terrible soul to enter him. He was on the wrong side of the boys' division to see the lighted window in Nurse Angela's office, but he could look over the building, up the hillside, and see the light from the window illuminating the eroded, unplanted hill. He couldn't see where the light was coming from, and this disquieted him. It seemed eerie how a light from nowhere was making the stripped hill glow all the way into the black edge of the woods. The stationmaster could have wept at his own timidity, but he cursed himself instead. So much of his sleep was lost to fear, and the first train of the morning was such an early train. For most of the year, the train arrived when it was still dark. And those women who were on it sometimes. The station master shuddered. Those women in the loose clothes, always asking where the orphanage was. Some of them back the same evening, their faces like ash, the color of so many of the faces in the station master's night terrors. Very nearly, he thought, the color of Clara's face, though the station master didn't know her name. His one look at Clara had been so brief that it was unfair he should be doomed to see her so many times since, and each time he saw more of her in his dreams. When the station master heard what he thought were voices, he looked over the boys' division at the lit hillside above St. Cloud's, and that was when he saw the towering shadows of Wilbur Larch and Homer Wells, stretching, in the case of one, to the wood's dark edge, and in the case of the other, stretching into the sky. The two giant figures flapped their huge, hill-spanning arms. Whipped by the wind, the station master caught the word, sorcerer. It was then he knew that he could walk, or even run, all night. But he could not escape. Not this time. The last thought that the station master had was that the time for him and for all the world had come. The next morning, the sea breeze still stirred St. Cloud's. Even Melanie noticed it. Her usual grouchiness was suspended. She had trouble waking up, although she'd passed a wakeful night. She'd had the impression that all night an animal was prowling the grounds of the girls' division, probably getting into the trash. And she'd been able to observe the two women walking up the hill from the train station in the pre-dawn glow. The women were not speaking to each other. They probably didn't know each other. They had certainly guessed each other's circumstances. The women walked head down. They were both overdressed for the spring. Melanie watched the wind press their baggy winter coats against the women's bodies. They didn't look pregnant, Melanie observed. She reminded herself to be on hand at her favorite window to watch the women heading down the hill for the evening train. With what they were giving up, Melanie thought, one might expect their returning steps to be lighter. And after all, they were heading downhill. But every time, the women walked more heavily down the hill than they had walked up it. It appeared they'd been given something to carry away with them. Their gait was quite the contrary from what one might expect in the gait of women who'd been truly scraped clean. Scraped not so clean, maybe, Melanie thought. Although Homer Wells had told her nothing, what trouble could exist that Melanie couldn't see? Whatever there was that glimmered of wrong, that shone of mistake, of loss, of hope abandoned, of the grim choices that were possible, Melanie had an eye expertly trained to see this and more. She'd not yet set foot outdoors, but she could tell something different was in the wind. She could not see the body of the station master. He had fallen in the weeds by the delivery entrance to the boys' division, which was little used. There was a separate delivery entrance for the hospital. From his window on the world, from Nurse Angela's office, Dr. Larch could not have seen the weeds where the station master lay stiffening either. And it was not the station master's departed soul that troubled Larch that morning. He'd had other sleepless nights. Sea breezes were rare, but he had felt them. There'd been a fight in the girls' division that had required some stitching in one girl's lip and in another girl's eyebrow. But Wilbur Larch wasn't worried about those girls. Homer Wells had done a very neat job with the lip. Larch had handled the eyebrow, which presented more of a problem with permanent scarring. And the two women who were waiting for their abortions were very early in their respective pregnancies, and, in Nurse Edna's judgment, both seemed robust and sane. And there was an almost cheerful woman from Damariscotta. She'd just begun her contractions, which appeared to be perfectly normal. She'd had one previous delivery very routine, and so Larch anticipated no difficulty with her. He was thinking he'd have Homer deliver the Damariscotta woman because it looked straightforward and because the woman, Nurse Angela had said, had taken a particular liking to Homer. She'd talked up a storm to him every second he'd been around her. So what's wrong, thought Wilbur Larch. Or if not wrong, different. So what if the mail was late and the dining hall said there'd been no milk delivery? Larch didn't know, and wouldn't have cared, that the train station had been more than usually disorganized in the station master's absence. He didn't know that the station master was missing. Wilbur Larch had noticed no disturbance among the souls crowding the sky above St. Cloud's. With the work he felt was his calling, Dr. Larch could not afford too rigorous a contemplation of the soul. Previous to this morning, Homer Wells had not been presented with an occasion to contemplate the soul. A study of the soul had not been a part of his training, and since there were no windows in the room where Homer conducted his studies of Clara, it was not the station master, or his soul, that suddenly presented itself to Homer Wells. Dr. Larch had asked Homer to prepare a fetus for an autopsy. A woman from Three Mile Falls had been stabbed, or she had stabbed herself. This was not unusual in Three Mile Falls, but the pregnancy of the woman was nearly full term, and the possibility of delivering a live baby from the dead woman had been unusual even for Dr. Larch. He had attempted to rescue the child, but the child, or rather the embryo, nearly 9 months, had not escaped one of the stab wounds. Like its mother, the child, or the fetus, as Dr. Larch preferred, had bled to death. It would have been a boy. That much was clear to Homer Wells, or even to the untrained eye. Whatever one called it, it was very nearly a fully developed baby. Dr. Larch had asked Homer to help him determine, more exactly than bled to death, the source of the fetus's bleeding. Homer Wells borrowed Dr. Larch's sternum shears before he realized that a pair of heavy scissors was all he needed to open the fetus's sternum. He cut straight up the middle, noticing immediately the slashed pulmonary artery. To his surprise, the wound was less than half an inch away from a wide-open ductus. In the fetus, the ductus arteriosus is half the size of the aorta. But Homer had never looked inside a fetus before. In the born, within 10 days, the ductus becomes nothing but a fibrous thread. This change is initiated not by any mystery, but by the first breath, which closes the ductus and opens the lungs. In the fetus, the ductus is a shunt. The blood bypasses the lungs on its way to the aorta. It should not have been a shock for Homer Wells to see the evidence that a fetus has little need for blood in its lungs. A fetus doesn't breathe. Yet Homer was shocked. The stab wound at the base of the ductus appeared as a second eye alongside the little opening of the ductus itself. The facts were straightforward enough. The ductus was wide open because this fetus had never taken its first breath. What was the life of the embryo but a history of development? Homer attached a tiny needle-nosed clamp to the severed pulmonary artery. He turned to the section in Gray's devoted to the embryo. It was another shock for him to remember that Gray's did not begin with the embryo, it ended with it. The embryo was the last thing considered. Homer Wells had seen the products of conception in many stages of development, in rather whole form, on occasion, and in such partial form as to be barely recognizable, too. Why the old black-and-white drawings should have affected him so strongly, he could not say. In Gray's, there was the profile view of the head of a human embryo, estimated at 27 days old. Not quick, as Dr. Larch would be quick to point out, and not recognizably human, either. What would be the spine was cocked like a wrist, and where the knuckles of the fist, above the wrist, would be, there was the ill-formed face of a fish. The kind that lives below light is never caught, could give you a nightmare. The undersurface of the head of the embryo gaped like an eel. The eyes were at the sides of the head, as if they could protect the creature from an attack from any direction. In 8 weeks, though still not quick, the fetus has a nose and a mouth. It has an expression, thought Homer Wells. And with this discovery, that a fetus, as early as 8 weeks, has an expression, Homer Wells felt in the presence of what others call a soul. He displayed the pulmonary artery of the baby from Three Mile Falls in a shallow, white enamel examining tray. He used 2 clamps to hold the chest incision open, and 1 more clamp to lift and expose the lacerated artery. The baby's cheeks appeared deflated. Someone's invisible hands appeared to press its small face at its sides. It lay on its back, resting on its elbows, its forearms held stiffly perpendicular to its chest. The tiny fingers of its hands were slightly open, as if the baby were preparing to catch a ball. Homer Wells did not care for the tattered appearance of the stump of the umbilical cord, which was also too long. He clipped it again and tied it off neatly. There was a little caked blood on the tiny penis, and Homer cleaned this away. A spot of old blood on the bright white edge of the enamel tray came off easily with just a cotton swab dabbed with alcohol. The color of the dead baby, especially against the whiteness of the tray, was of something sallow going gray. Homer turned to the sink and vomited rather deftly in it. When he ran the faucet to clean the